You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys were rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take it.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like you.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to One Heat Minute. I could not express to you in words how amazing this experiences for me, the person I'm about to talk to. In my wildest dreams starting this project, I never thought we would talk to key creative people who contributed to the movie, but today on One Heat Minute for episode 152, I'm talking to the editor, one of the editors, Mr. Pasquale Buber. Thank you, Joe Lynch. Pasquale Buber, welcome to One Heat Minute. It is an absolute honor and a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here, and I appreciate what you're doing because, you know, I think it's a phenomenal, perhaps a little insane, but a phenomenal task that you set aside for yourself. And, you know, for an editor taking each minute separately and analyzing it is, I did listen a couple of your episodes. And the depth of knowledge that you and your guests have about this film is just—it's insane. It's outstanding. And I will, for full disclosure, you know, this has been it was 95.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. I went to the Academy screening of the film, which is the first time I had seen it in many, many years. But your knowledge of this film right now, you know, my memory banks, a lot of them are gone about this film. What happens is when you finish a movie, you know everything about it. And then when you start a new film, you kind of just reformat your drives and start again from fresh.
Yes.
But one of the things that talking about this reminded me is that the assistants, we would hang around on when we had some downtime on the soundstage and do trivia contests. And it was like, what was the flight number of the Cessna? What cell block was breeding in, you know, and we'd go to these phenomenally intricate trivia questions. And because everybody had seen the film and screenings and mixing and cutting, we all actually did have answers for it.
Oh my God, that would be my favorite trivia night ever to be at. I'd probably lose with all those guys who'd seen it cut 1,000 times, but I'd be taking notes frantically with every answer.
But that was 25 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah. Synapses were out, everyone. You know.
Well, we are going to watch. So, as I said right from the top, Pasquale Buber was on the Movie Crypt podcast doing a fantastic almost career retrospective bookending Heat, which is Joe Lynch's, one of Joe Lynch's favorite films, and Dawn of the Dead, and talking about his relationship with the horror master and just a key influencer of a stack of cinema, social horror, and just horror genre in general, George A. Romero. So in that episode, there was a brief fleeting moment where sort of Pascal reminisced about one particular minute that he loved because he cut it, and he talked about it being, when he actually cut it together, it was actually one of the first takes of this cut. So we're going to have a little listen to it right now. You guys are going to listen to a nice high def version. We're going to watch it again really briefly together. Pascal's watched it, and then we're going to come back and unpack it. And then beyond that, we're just going to gush with Pascal about his amazing work and talk about all the things that he can remember from Heat. So thank you so much. Have a listen, and here we go.
She picked her place. It's not right what happened to her.
No, it's not.
Is there any way that it could work out between us?
I wish I could say yes, you know. But in the end, you know, it's like you said. All I am is what I'm going after.
That is a magnificent minute.
Yeah, the facial expressions. I mean, that's such a unforgiving shot in a lot of ways. You know that of Al. I mean, there's no room for any error. That is full screen.
Yes.
And Dante's phenomenal, but the way that that scene is staged as to when somebody would walk past the frame and when people would look at each other. It was just, it's all between the two actors, who are very good friends. I mean, they're both from New York, and they worked together before. But when you see the little subtle things that, in that scene, Al takes chewing gum to an art form.
Yes.
If you just watch the way he chews, because he doesn't chew gum a lot of times. Sometimes he doesn't, but not as a habit. But in that, just the pacing of the chew and the looks of his eyes, and you can see every layer that's going on with him about, when he gets the call on a phone and he puts it down, but then she, you know, the realization of coming to that line about, you know, you were right. All I am is what I've been going after. I'm no different than the people I'm chasing. And that realization is, you know, to be able to express that, it's something he knew, but Hannah verbalizes it there. And there's just so much, there's a little pause. I'm glad you showed it again, because it reminded me there's, right before he says, it's like you always said, and he looks away to the thing, and then he looks back at her, and he lowers his voice, and it's done in a whisper, you know. There's a great little thing at the end, too, when he finally, when she releases him, and he goes, and as he gets up, she does a little wave with her hand, just, and then that look that he does when he looks back at her, it's a kind of shit-eating grin on his face, but because he knows he's released in a certain way, that he can get back to what has been burning inside of him. And then that run down the stairs, which is, you know, man descending stairs. Remember, we had to lower the production. We took out all the production audio in there in a Foley because he goes down the stairs so fast.
Yeah. I love what you talked about with Justine there. So with Diane Venora, she's such a striking, beautiful woman. And in so much of the movie, she's so, even in when they've had a big breakup moment where Ralph is at the house, she's still very,
Ralph.
She's exceptionally put together. And in this moment, she's pure vulnerability. There's no makeup. Yeah. There's no artifice to her hair. And there is a sense that in this moment, and I love this about her performance, it's just this aching, I know that, and she knows she's right. And she says, is there any way we can work it out? And I love that I look at her face and I think she knows what the answer needs to be. And that's what that great, you talk about that, just the beautiful action and reaction and that energy that's going back and forth between them. is that Vincent for a moment has to feign a pause. He's like, I know this is denial. This is a moment where I could say, yes, everything's going to work out. But it's like in that split second that you reference, I feel like a whole 10 years or 5 years or a year flashes through his head of what is this relationship going to be like? And then he has to, the gum is like him literally chewing on that information and coming to terms with it and looking at her and going, it's like he said, like, you know this. I don't even need to tell you this, but you know this. All I am is what I'm going after. And it's such a great scene. I love this is the frustration and the brilliance of this format is you take the Edie and Neil scene and there's none of the self-awareness. Like Neil's like, I want you to come with me. And she's like, yes, I will come with you. She agrees. And you immediately, you feel sick because you're like, this is not going to, something is not right. And in this moment, as sad and as heartbreaking it is, I feel, you just go, yeah, that is, in this moment, he's actually made the right choice to kind of set her free because he knows what his destiny is.
Yeah. And that this comes after the, when he rushes into the hospital and she witnesses, she's hurt. You know, he doesn't talk about what he does for a living.
No.
But she actually gets to witness it. He comes into that emergency room and takes complete command and control.
Yes.
The entire emergency room. And commanding this, I want this, and I need an incubator, you know. And she's there, and she's absorbing it. She's just aware of the fact that this guy does know, you know, there's something to him. He does know what he's doing. And this, of course, comes, I think, three scenes or so after the I have to screw Ralph for closure scene. You know, but,
yes. Yes.
And kicking
the TV.
Kicking the TV out of the car and then Neil.
Can I ask you, this is a theory I've had, Pasquale. The TV scene, do the people at the bus stop know that they're in a movie? Because I love that scene where he's so frustrated he kicks his TV out of the car. But every time I've watched it, and I've watched that scene many times in preparation for this show and just in general, and I feel like the people at the bus stop are like, is that Al Pacino kicking a TV out of the car? Like they feel like they don't know that that's a guy. They don't know he's an actor. I don't know what it is. I get that sense when I watch that scene that it's like, I don't even know if this bus stop was prepared to, as actors, they're just being shot sort of secretly by a camera down the road.
It's shot multiple times. I mean, there's a, when the car leaves and the door,
yes,
the door automatically closes as he peels out, the guys are still there.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that wasn't shot. It wasn't shot. You know, I'm sure they went in and inserts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Maybe they didn't know he was going to kick the TV up. But I'm, you know, I'd have to, you know, I'm not really sure of it, but I'm pretty sure that they probably were there.
They were there. So yeah, you were talking, I mean, it's, and we're so close to ultimately the epic climax to this movie. And it feels like these are like emotionally climactic moments. So when you guys are cutting it together, was it always going to be orchestrated like this, that we just never lost touch of like the deep, like personal and emotional connections to these people as it was building towards this climax? Is that how you guys were thinking about it when it was constructed?
Michael was, you know, if I could get, can I get wonky for a minute here?
Get wonky. Okay. Please.
This was in the primitive Stone Age days of nonlinear editing. This was the first film Michael did on nonlinear system.
Yes.
I did a film the previous year with Al called a Shakespeare Project at that time. It ended up being Looking for Richard.
Yes.
And I had cut on a nonlinear system. And then I went on to Casino while they were in Las Vegas, and that was Scorsese and Thelma's first experience on nonlinear editing. And I came back, and then we did Heat.
So just pause for 1 second, ladies and gentlemen. That's right, Pasquale just said he was cutting Casino with Thelma and Martin Scorsese. So we can all just savor that for a brief second, and now let's move back into the story.
I told you that not for my resume, but for the fact that we were all learning how to deal with the new structure of nonlinear editing.
Yes.
Because in addition to the fact that it was that you could call up things instantly, at that time there were very physical limitations. We were using Lightworks, and it was an IBM-based system. It needed SCSI drives, and SCSI drives only at that time held, I think, less than a It was megabytes. It wasn't gigabytes.
Yes.
See, the amount of storage on each drive was limited. Plus, you could only have seven of them tied to the editing machine at one time. So you had these things called towers, and you'd have to unplug the tower and bring a new one in and do it. So everything was very, very fragmented because you didn't have all the material in front of you at all times.
Yes.
We worked. Michael would go from room to room with the editors. He would run the film in his mind, knew what point he was, and kind of describe it to us. Because we couldn't even watch. You know, we'd go in the other guys' rooms and watch things, but still watching the whole flow of it was in Michael's mind.
Yes.
Until we started screening, and then once we started screening, that's when we started knowing the shape of things. And there was this drive because I did the scene of when he bring her to the emergency room and the first waiting room scene and this scene and something that happened after that, and somebody else did was doing the hotel scene, and so we had to eventually intercut the scenes, and that was the first time we saw how it was all working. But Michael would come into the room and do this. and figure out exactly where he was at that particular time in the movie, and talk about the energy and stuff like that. But once we started screening it, and once we started seeing the whole process, then we knew as editors how to focus in and how to keep the drive, how to keep it going.
What, from a technical perspective, and I guess this is great for anyone who's listening, when you finally have, I guess, an assembly cut that you're screening to sort of go, okay, this is what it looks like. How much more do things drastically change in those moments? Like, would you have this massive assembly cut and go, well, the tone of that particular take, we need to recut the whole thing because the energy dips in a wrong way? Does that happen pretty significantly, or did it happen?
That happens non-linear, or when you're cutting, because you still, like my first assemblies as an editor, you know, I would cut each scene, and once I was happy with the scene that I knew I could massage it and make changes to it later, I would put it away and not look at it.
Yes.
Until I watched the whole film.
Yes.
Because a scene does not exist without, which is very, no offense to people who are doing this 1 minute at a time. You know, a scene doesn't exist in its own terms. It has to have the rhythm and structure of what precedes it and what's going to follow it.
And so you've heard it now. Pascual Buba recommends listening to all 170 completed episodes back to back.
In order, at one time, without getting up. It's the only way to do this.
The insanity of this project continues. All right, great. So yeah, so you're in that moment, and you're like, this scene works, but if I need to change the tone, I've got options for myself.
Yeah, and at that time too, we were screening dailies on film, projected dailies. This was shot 2:33 anamorphic, so we would see widescreen dailies, and we got the impact of dailies. But we were still, and as editors, we were getting accustomed to cutting on video.
Yeah,
because you're looking at video monitors, and there is a difference with the amount of information you get from any given video frame versus the information you get from film frames. So the other big transition we all had to get accustomed to was making the transition from seeing something played back on a TV monitor to seeing it on a big screen.
Yeah,
and that was always, until the vocabulary started building up among editors that you knew how to make that translation. But that's also another kind of, you know, rude awakening. But at that time on Heat, they don't do this anymore because people are not shooting film as much. But we conformed after we had a certain percentage of the film cut. The assistant started conforming the work print.
Yes.
So then we could actually screen a projected work print. You know, so you always had an idea of what you're leaving in your little 21-inch, 13-inch Sony, and what you're going to see on a widescreen TV. I mean, a widescreen, a regular widescreen.
So you're cutting this scene. Let's go back to the scene. This is one of your favorites. And how do you remember offhand how many takes there were before that you had to watch? And my other question is, is it rare then when you see the first take that you just sort of, I imagine you must go, God, we kind of nailed it so perfectly in just one take. You're like, oh, I have to see every take.
No, it wasn't necessarily, I didn't mean that they only shot one take.
Yeah.
It was one of the scenes where my first cut.
Ah, your first cut, sorry.
For a long time.
Yes.
Because the material was there, and you know, it's probably from a couple different takes. but the material was there, and it just, it was, it's well written and well shot and well acted, which makes an editor's job much, much easier. But I do remember as I was editing it, just being, you know, and I had done, you know, as I said, I did Looking for Richard Waddell, and I knew him as, you know, the power of him as an actor. But actually watching that scene, there's just so many little nuances within his eyes and with his face, and just, you know, he's totally, there's so much more going on besides just saying the words.
Yes.
I mean, he's always, his eyes are always thinking, you know, you can always see that there's a process going on of what he's doing.
And there's massive chunks of this long movie where people aren't saying a word of dialogue. Everything's being conveyed in gestures and expressions and sort of, as you said, darting eyes to seeking out information. It's almost like looking it up in their own hard drive in their brain and sort of, you know, chunking whether this is going to be the right decision and then going back. And this is one thing I'm desperate to do, and I haven't, and in Australia there hasn't been one. Maybe we'll have to get one organized for the podcast, but it's actually seeing if we can get a 35mm print of the original, or like a new 4K print of the definitive edition, to actually see it on a big screen and sit in a cinema on a beautiful projection and watch the mastery of sort of these nuanced performances right up close and seeing them on a massive canvas, because I think so many people are used to watching them now on home video or even in good setups, even with a projector. They just, it doesn't seem to hold a candle to what that that cinematic experience would have been with this film.
It is. It's like the first time I saw Searchers on a big screen.
Oh.
You know, and Heat is that film because Dante, Michael was very, has a very strong color structure.
Yes.
When I first time I met him in an office for the interview, he had all these photos on a wall from magazines, and they were arranged in colors from blues to different things. So he had a whole color scheme about how the movie was going to look, and Dante obviously, you know, was able to capture that too. So Michael's an architect in a lot of ways. He sees things architecturally.
Yes.
In terms of shapes and curves and, you know, how things mathematically change, and it's very interesting to work with him that way. But he has, you know, he has that vision of the film in his mind, and so it. Unfortunately, on, you know, watching it on an iPad doesn't do what it was intended to be.
No, not at all.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, sorry. I was just going to say, so when you're cutting this together, this magnificent thing, when do you realize that, wow, this is like, and is there a point where you said, wow, this is kind of a, this could be a masterpiece. Was it a particular moment when you were cutting a particular scene, or was it finally looking at an assembly cut and going, holy dooly, these, you know, obviously Al, you'd worked with him before. Al's absolutely the top of his game. Diane Venora, I mean, Ashley Judd, Val Kilmer, De Niro. Like, it's just a murderer's row of phenomenal performers, all guns blazing, really just delivering every scene. So was there a moment that you're cutting it together and they're going, wow, this is something incredible? Or is it even at that early stage when you're in a room with Michael Mann and he's got the color schemes figured out that you're like, this could be pretty special?
It was at the premiere.
Yeah.
When my wife cried.
What scene? The final scene?
At the end of the, no, at the, end
the final, yeah. I mean, look, I cry every time I see it myself in that scene.
We had, you know, I mean, I was away from home a lot, obviously, on the hours. And, She would just always make that thing about, this better be worth it. And then at the end of it, she grabbed my hand and said, it was worth it.
Oh,
that, so I knew that.
That is
that
magic.
Was a special movie. Because and that does, you know, we were pretty busy up to the end, you know, and, you know, we had went to New York and screened it with the press people. We only had two preview screenings in Pasadena, and that was, you know, and they were kind of perfunctory screenings because they people knew that the film was working, so but you still had to get in front of an audience in case there were things that, you know, that bumped that you weren't aware of.
Yes.
But and they both, and nobody, the thing is, in that both screenings is for 2 hours and whatever it is, there was no movement and not that many people left the room, you know. And that was a test of that they kept their asses in the seats, and which is important for a long running movie.
Yes.
Because the rhythms can get a little odd, you know, where people's kind of metabolism goes when you're watching the movie.
There's so many films, but, and you would know this better than anyone as an editor, and I imagine it's even more acute for you when you're watching some films, is you're in there, and if the pacing's off, and if the editing's rough, and if the script is too flabby in certain moments and they haven't been able to tighten it, it's almost an uncontrollable impulse to flick your hand up and look at your watch and go, what is going on? And I can't ever remember any time I've ever looked at my watch watching Heat. There's not a moment you want to take your eyes off the screen. And even in the slower, more intimate moments, they're still fascinating. They're still absolutely, they're so engrossing that you don't want to take your eyes off it. And once you're in that middle heist, which is kind of a semi-climactic moment in that middle of the, you know, sort of late middle of the film, you can't even believe where you are, and there's still so much to go. So it's even more tense in that final sort of half an hour, that build-up, which is right where this scene falls, right to the end. It's just, it's rolling. It's got such a phenomenal momentum.
Yeah. But in that thing, there's also, and I just, another thing that I've always loved about this film was, I said, like, Al makes chewing gum an art form, but the double take that he does when he recognizes that Amy's sitting by herself in a car,
yes.
He puts it all together. It's just a double take he does, and it's so subtle. It's just phenomenal. The communal experience of watching the film with a lot of people is, you know, that's where you really know, you know, what's working, what's not working.
So you've worked with Al a couple of times. When Al watched it, we're in there at the premiere and you guys are all watching it together. Like, what did those guys say about it? Did you get some insights from those guys that were really happy with it? Because obviously in the latest 20th anniversary piece, you hear them talking about it, being really proud of it. But at the time, were they like, wow, this is actually, you know,
I imagine. The actor, they see the movie before premieres. In fact, usually at the premiere, you know, they go out and then they come back for the party afterwards. But they've seen the movie as courtesy screenings way before the premiere. So they have their own, and then they have their own meetings with the directors. At that time we were still doing Looking for Richard. And I would, there was an editor working in Los Angeles on it. So I was participating with Elle on that while we were doing Heat. I was younger then, I could do that. but then we went and finished Looking for Richard. And the other big release I ever got was, because Looking for Richard was, we made that in the editing room. It was kind of a theory Elle had, and we kind of, you know, we worked on it. And then we screened it at Sundance for the first time, we put it in front of a big audience. And we realized that it was actually a movie. You know, it actually could be a film.
Yes.
It was just kind of this thing we were working out of my house here in Los Angeles, just on a computer, and had fun, but didn't know what, you know, how it was going to all put together.
Yes.
And but it's actually, you know, it's one of my favorite movies because it was actually, as an editor, because it was actually written in the editing room, literally.
Yes.
You know, we're making it up as we went along. You know, Al had the vision. He did have the vision in his mind. It was a question of pulling it together.
So Michael Mann, he's got the entire script. When you're interviewing to edit, were you ever like reading the script and going, okay, I sort of see what this is going to be. This is, the scope is going to be this massive. Or is that sort of, you're there participating on set, checking things out and going, okay, seeing the dailies, all right, this is what's going to happen. What's your process as far as being in that sort of that role?
Michael was very big on dailies. I mean, dailies were at that time a big event because that's when he would give out a lot of notes. Excuse me. And Michael had a microcassette, and he would dictate as he was watching. He would talk a lot into the microcassette as he was watching dailies, and then we could transcribe, and then you'd get those notes the next day. It was very, very quick because actually I was working. Dove Honing, who had worked with Michael on a lot of his early movies, was still tied up on Batman at
yes.
the time. And so I came in early. I came in very early on Heat. But they had already been shooting for a few days, for I think like 10 days, maybe a week. And so, and then we were, again, just setting up equipment. So it took a while to set up the nonlinear system because, again, there weren't a lot of assistants who knew the electronic end of it.
Yes.
You know, so we were, you know, it was always scrambling, trying to figure out how to bridge into this new world that we were going to deal with. And so, and we still had the cameras, we still had film in, you know, in the cutting rooms because we'd still watch film. But the process built slowly because the way that the out of orderness that they started shooting. You know, I think the first scene, I really cut was the BJ scene. Yeah, I was the first one. It was shot in a lot of multi cameras on the scene where he goes down and meets. You know, he hears the word slick.
Yes,
I think that club was called BJ's. I think that's funny.
And now, thankfully, perfectly, you lead in to the secret moment that you revealed on the Movie Crypt podcast, and I would love if you could talk more about it. So, on the 20th anniversary of Heat, the Christopher Nolan Q&A with Michael Mann and the entire cast, it was revealed that Vincent Hanna was originally conceived of as a cop character who took drugs, including copping a bit of cocaine. And at that famous BJ scene with that really, really iconic security guard that Pacino comes up and goes, "Give me all your money." That moment was a scene where Vincent cops some cocaine. Is that right?
Yeah. It's actually scripted. That's why I was, you know, didn't know why it was, you know, it was a surprise to people, but excuse me, it was scripted that way.
Yes.
And he goes up to, and that guy actually is a guy who owned, here's another weird story about it. The guy playing the doorman was a guy who owned the dog. Well, I know.
The dog fighting rink that they shot. Holy dooly.
There's some story about that. I'm not sure what it was, but I remember there was some story about it.
Wow.
But he goes up to him, "Give me all he got." And there's a lot of jesting that's going on between the two of them. And then he says, "Who takes care of you?" And the doorman shakes his hand and slips him a little pad of coke that he does in the elevator on the way down the steps. And that, you know, it cut off pretty early on. But there's always there in that scene, and because in the BJ's, there was Michael was always worried about it dying in pace there.
Yes.
We had, matter of fact, our first screening in Pasadena. First preview screen. We sat there and we had been up for God knows how many days in a row mixing. And we watched it and thank God, you know, and maybe I'll get some sleep tonight before the screening. And this was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon when we had a run through. And Michael comes up to me and puts his arm around me and says, "You know, there's a cut I can see in the BJ scene where we can cut from this piece of dialogue to this piece of dialogue." It was in the exchange between Tone Loc and Al. And I said, "Oh, yeah, it's interesting. I'll get on that tomorrow morning." And I looked at him and I realized he didn't mean tomorrow morning. He meant now. So I had to take the film off of the platter. I was in the editing room, or the projection room, you know, flipping through film, pulling a section out of the film. And we cut maybe 30 seconds out of that scene. But it did, and it did help the pace. And he was always worried about the pace in that scene, so we kept massaging it. Because it was just where that scene happened in the film.
Yeah.
The reason for cutting out the coke thing, I really don't know. It was an early decision, that was And the two things I always thought is that yes, it would be interesting to see the film with that scene in it, whether or not it would make a difference. The other thing, if anybody ever had $130 million and didn't know what to do with it, would be to reshoot this film and change the two characters.
Oh my God!
Have Al play Hannah. Have Al play Neo and De Niro play Hannah.
And flip the whole cruise. Have Kilmer as a cop. Have Drucker. You know, just flip the entire script and have everyone playing the opposite characters. I think they could do it. Oh my God! Imagine.
Yeah, too bad it's not a repertoire company that could do it that way.
Oh, that would be.
And that was, you know, what's his name? Breeden, Dennis Hasbro. Yeah. That's the first time I met, because I did those scenes of in the thing. the first time I'd seen, I didn't know who the actor was. You know, it was this big, imposing man who had such a great look on camera.
Oh, amazing presence.
And now, you know, he's been president of the United States. He's yep. Dell's Insurance, you know, great guy. But very, very talented actor.
Was that something on set?
But there was...
Was that something you guys ever talked about? Like, oh, God, I would love to see us just run a scene with Al as Macaulay and De Niro? Was that like a sort of with you?
Oh, no. That's my own perverted thoughts, you know, that I have while sitting in the cutting room. Because it's just, you know, it's always interesting that it's perfectly cast the way it is.
Yes.
But you have two guys who are capable of doing so much.
Yes.
That it would just be interesting to see what the dynamic, all the dynamics would change.
Have you heard about this Heat prequel novel that Michael is writing?
No.
Yeah, there's a Heat prequel novel, and that apparently he's writing about both characters. So that, you know, how Macaulay got to where he was, obviously leading up into the events of Heat, and then how Vincent became Vincent, the top cop in Robbery Homicide. And then somewhere along the line, and I don't know if it's just the rumor mill, but they say, oh, he's writing the novel with the intention that eventually he may shoot it as a prequel film. And so then it starts to be like, who's going to play those guys? Who would play those guys as young men?
Right now they're playing themselves as young men in a film called, oh God, I forget the name of it now. But they are playing themselves as younger people. I think they're doing face.
Oh, the new Scorsese movie.
Yes.
Is it The Irishman? The Irishman.
The Irishman. Yes.
The Irishman. That's right.
The Payne houses. Yeah. But they're doing the face changes. But you know, Neil is a real character, and his name is Neil.
Neil Macaulay.
He's from Chicago, and he actually killed somebody named, you know, in a hotel somewhere.
Yes.
I think the character based on Hannah is not, his name wasn't Hannah, but he's based on another person than Michael. Because Michael, you know, all the stuff comes out of his, you know, his growing up in Chicago. Because I think originally he was in Chicago.
Yeah, and then they changed a lot.
And he changed it. But the brilliance of what they did and what was the pursuit of two people who don't get to see each other except for one scene. And casting two actors as famous as Pacino and De Niro, who have never really were in any movie together in a scene.
Yes.
It was just really made that film just extra special that way. Because there is a whole layer of reveal of each other's characters. There's one scene that was cut out of the film, which was after the first heist, the news reporter. They had this helicopter footage.
Yes.
And they had helicopter footage of the ambulance blowing up by accident. And they just were shooting it, and the ambulance blew up. And the character of Neil comes out, and you can't really see him on the screen because it's just green.
Yes.
And then, you know, there's a scene outside the heist of the metals heist.
Yes.
Where he's an infrared image.
In the infrared, yeah.
And so they, you know, gradually start becoming more and more clear to each other. Then there's a thing of De Niro taking pictures of Pacino. And there's never once one two shot in the film until the very last shot where he holds his hand.
Yes. It's
the first time you see both of them in the frame at the same time. And that, you know, that's the stuff that kind of, you know, really makes the film special in a lot of ways. You know, I remember God, there was all this stuff flying around about they weren't together, they didn't do that scene together.
Yes.
You know, they shot it separately. You know,
and so then
and then
Michael had to start posting the Kate Manolini photos of them both together in the same frame, and then those pictures of Michael talking to them both in the behind the scenes shots and stuff like that to go, oh no, they were together, and they were together in that final scene as well.
Yeah, because there were, you know, there were two shots. There were you know, it was a wide shot to begin the shot. There was an overhead shot in the two of them, and then Michael went through, and we wanted to remove all of the two shots from the film because it occurred to him that that, you know, in order to keep the pursuit going, that it was better that they didn't come. And then the power of that last frame,
yeah,
you know, at the airport is what makes that pay off.
And also a scene that could never be shot today, never.
You know,
in a post 9/11 world, you could not ever shoot that scene in that same way ever again. It's an unbelievable document.
I don't know how they shot it back then.
Wow.
You know, it was intense because, you know, they were at the airport.
Yeah.
You know, and I think they had to be careful about their own lights, not confusing the pilots.
Yeah.
But that whole jet, it moves, you know, it's total bananas.
Yeah.
But it didn't cheat. I mean, it gives the impact of that film and the strength of it. And it's just two guys chasing each other at those lights.
I just love that. It's such a big, for such a big movie, to end so intimately in this really just in a foot chase. And you know, at this crossroads, you know, the escape's right there, and he's just got to bear that the escape route's just flying and reminding him constantly over his head, and it's just, yeah.
And catching that one shadow.
Yes.
You know, by the time of the jet, seeing that one shadow, which is why Hannah wins the fight.
I think your wife's moment that it was worth it is something that I'm going to remember from everything that you've revealed today. I think that's that moment where it resonates. It's and you don't have to have been the person making it or be a massive fan of these amazing performers and knowing it granular, but it's just that it can resonate with just anyone. It's an amazing film.
Yeah, well, you know, growing up in Pittsburgh, the and making, you know, working with George, you know, we knew it was time. My wife is a production manager, so we wanted to move. You know, it was either New York or Los Angeles. We came out here, but one of the things that convinced me to move was seeing Dog Day Afternoon.
Yes,
and at Dog Day Afternoon, there's a shot of Al at the end of the film on a trunk of the car. There was something about that performance. I said, I want to go and see if I can end up working with people like this. And, you know, one of the very, very fortunate that, you know, I ended up having that particular dream and wish fulfilled, you know, because I, you know, and Heat was a perfect example of something I imagined that I could be doing back when I was back in Pittsburgh, and came out here and was able to do it.
Well, speaking right now from Sydney, I never would have dreamed that I would be talking to Pascal Buber, the editor of my favorite film of all time and a masterpiece, Heat, and getting such rich insights. And I'm going to go back myself and listen to you talk about Al Pacino's performance in that scene and Diane Venora. Pascal, I know we've talked about this minute, and so I don't want to wrap it up, but I want to ask, would you come back for another minute along our journey? Because we would love, and I'm sure once our people who are listening get to hear some of your descriptions and some of your insights, they would be ravenous to hear more. So would you come back to a One Heat Minute for us along our journey?
You mean, would I want to come back and talk about a film I love? Yeah, sure.
Yes.
No, absolutely.
Look,
no, absolutely.
Pascal, I just want to say, this is like bucket list kind of stuff. Thank you so much for being a part of One Heat Minute.
Well, thank you for being such a, you know, and you, and, you know, as I told Joe too, that, you know, you do these things, and it's, God, it was a long time ago, and you don't realize, you know, that the impact that you're still having now. This is true a lot with Romero's films, because when they got released, there was no ancillary video, there was no ancillary markets.
Yes.
So they kind of just appeared. Dawn of the Day of the Dead played for 3 days and went away. See. Now people know every frame of that.
Every frame of that movie people adore. I think if Romero fans are going to be probably screaming at me because they're hearing you talk and being able to talk about Romero. But guys, if I can encourage you to go and listen to the Movie Crit podcast, because Joe and Adam really get into Pascal talking about that. And I know that you guys have lined up another time to talk about it, because Joe just absolutely adores that film. But yeah, I mean, Heat for me, my first viewing of Heat as a kid in Australia was on VHS, and it grew from there with me, watching it on VHS, watching it, getting an opportunity to see it on like a big screen, on even just like a bigger projection. And the obsession is all mounted from home video. That's where the deep obsession has come from there. So some of the folks I've been able to speak to You know, there's been such a variety. You know, I've got a friend, Shane, who's done the show, who was over in Chicago and saw it in Chicago. Alicia Malone, an Australian critic, lives in LA. She's just done a One Heat Minute, talked about a special rooftop screening she recently did of Heat in LA that had headphones on so that they couldn't hear the choppers that were flying around LA. But people in LA flocked to this rooftop screening to show this quintessential LA movie in LA. You know, Joe talks about seeing it at the theaters. A famous Australian editor as well, Luke Doolin, who's still working in LA at the moment in Venice. He talks about he bought the script to Heat before it came out and had it shipped to Australia. So he's got it somewhere. The script is at his mum's house in New South Wales in Australia before he saw the film in theatres. So, you know, it's a film that's had a phenomenal impact, and I feel really honoured to be the person who can sort of keep this stoke this campfire that people can come around and tell stories. So thank you so much for being such an amazing participant, and thank you for being a part of it.
My pleasure, absolutely my pleasure.
Look, guys, you've been listening to One Heat Minute. This is Pascal Buber, a dream come true. For me, I'm Blake Howard. oneheatminute.com. You want to subscribe, rate and review the podcast, please do. And hopefully we'll talk to Pascal again about joining us, and I can't wait for that again. Thank you, Pascal.
My pleasure. Take care.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.